Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale. We are now joined by former President Donald Trump. Mr. President, welcome back. Good to have you.
Good morning.
The CPI number just came out at 0.3%. That means 3.6 year over year. It's still too high. What's your reaction to that number, Mr. President?
Well, it's way too high, but if you go back 2 years, you see that was where it was just so bad and nothing's happening. You know, you're still way up in the stratosphere, close to 30%, the real numbers. Remember, they leave a lot of numbers out. You know, this crazy Biden administration, everything's a game. And they leave a lot of numbers out. They leave the highest numbers, the worst numbers. Oftentimes they'll leave rental out. They'll leave a certain food type out. The whole thing is rigged. They are the worst.
This is
the worst president. Hey, you, this is, and you don't have to say it, I will. This is the worst president in the history of the United States, and it's not even close. And you can take the 10 worst and add them up, and they're not as bad as this guy. And look, the inflation's bad, and the number today is bad. They want to try for the, you know, this is like using the strategic reserves for gasoline. They want to try and play around with the interest rates with the Federal Reserve, but you can't lower them because of the fact that you have the inflation. It's a lot of inflation when added to the inflation that we've suffered that's been so bad. It's got to come down much more. That's a lot of inflation, their number.
Combined with blue state taxes, it's an incredible burden. People are fleeing California, for example. Hey, quick question. LeBron James can leave California, go back to Ohio if he wants. Given the taxes and the inflation in California, should he do that, Mr. President?
Well, I'm not a fan of LeBron James. I have a lot of players that I like better than LeBron, although he's an excellent basketball player, but I don't like his politics one bit. This nation would be destroyed if you went by his politics. You remember he endorsed the great Hillary Clinton, and that endorsement was a disaster. She got on stage, she walked up to him, and she came up to his belt buckle. I said, that's not a good look. That is not a good look for our president. But
shouldn't he flee California taxes like I did, like everyone else did?
Is he thinking about leaving California, going back?
Oh yeah, he showed up at Cavaliers Rocket Mortgage on two nights ago for the Cavs' fourth game. So there's some speculation he might come back to Ohio.
Well, Dan Gilbert's a good guy, and he's a smart owner, and that'll be interesting. Certainly, it's good to have LeBron James as a player.
Yeah. Now, let me talk to you about the debate challenge. President Biden just issued you a debate challenge for June and September with the Veeps talking in July. Do you accept?
Oh, absolutely. I've been trying to get, you know, he's issuing it. I wonder whether or not he shows up because, you know, he also challenged me to golf. So I'm a very good golfer. He can't hit a ball 50 yards. He said, I'll give him three aside. But he knows he'll never play. This is sort of like that, I think. But I hope not, because I really think he has to debate. He might as well get it over with. Probably should do it early so that he can, you know, he's not going to get any better.
June and September
every
is great.
Day is a down factor for him.
June and September would be great if you can agree on the size of the table and the moderators.
Well, why don't you look at the statement? I just put out a statement. You should have it on your hot wires. You get everything. I notice you get things very quickly. I put it out on Truth, and Truth is the hottest thing right now by far.
I will go look that up. Let me move on.
Do you want to read it? I'll look and see if Jason sent it to me on the back wire here.
I'll look for a second. Do you think if his infirmity increases, they will dump him, Mr. President, at the convention, replace him with Kamala or Gavin or someone like that?
I do. And I don't think they'll have a choice.
Will it be Gavin? Will it be Kamala or somebody else?
I don't know. I mean, Gavin's a terrible governor. Gavin Newsom, he's a terrible governor. I think he does a terrible job. I have things out in California, and you know, so beautiful, everything. The weather is the best. Everything is so good, but he just does a terrible job. You know, water, I had a deal for water to come down from the north. They have so much water, and they don't do it because they're trying to protect a tiny, tiny little fish that hasn't made it. And millions of gallons of water are sent into the Pacific Ocean, routed right into the Pacific instead of coming down throughout California. It's so
all right, I've got your statement. I'm ready to go. The dates that are proposed are fine. Anywhere, anytime, any place. Let's see if Joe can make it to the stand-up podium. I think they ought to go at least 2 hours. You think the president can stand up for 2 hours?
I think we should go 2 hours, yeah. I think we should go two.
Okay, let me turn to Israel.
Is important. He wants to sit down. You know, he wants to do things like he wants to sit down. I think a debate should be standing up. Don't you agree with that?
Well, I've done them both ways. The best debate in modern history was Lieberman and Cheney when they were sitting down. But that was a good moderator, and it went a long time. I don't think you're going to find a good moderator very easily. I really don't.
Didn't
I think you
think
should
my
have a
debates
liberal...
with Hillary were better? Didn't you think my debates
yes,
with
I did.
Hillary were really
yes, I did.
In all fairness.
I don't want Chris Wallace. I don't want Candy Crowley. I want someone who's fair, Mr. President. I just don't.
But let me ask you this. I'd like that, too. But I'd be willing to take anybody. You know, what difference does it make? I'd be willing to take anybody. But, you know, the commission got caught cheating with me. You know that.
Yes.
They turned down my sound, remember?
And they also canceled a debate without talking to you. They're so bad. They should have been exiled years ago. Now they're out of it. Let's talk about Israel, Mr. President. Last time you were on this show, a couple of months ago, you said they've got to finish the job. They need a victory. At that massive rally on Saturday, you said the same thing. Victory, victory, victory. What do you make of President Biden's arms embargo on offensive weapons declared last week?
It is not believable to me that he made the statement. All that does is prolong a war because it gives the other side tremendous energy when that happens. You know, it gives them a psychological energy. That was such a bad statement. And how a person that's Jewish can vote for this guy who's obviously mentally impaired, how a Jewish person can vote for him is beyond belief. I have friends that are Democrats. You know, they're good people, they're Jewish, and they're Democrats. And that's just fine being a Democrat. But I say, how do you vote for this guy? And many of them say we won't, but some say we will. It's almost like they're in a rut. They can't get out of the rut. But he is so bad for Israel. And I've been the best president with Golan Heights and moving the capital, Jerusalem, getting the embassy built. You know, we not only did I give the embassy, I got it built.
And you bankrupted Iran, or nearly bankrupted Iran. President Biden has refunded Iran. Will you put snapback sanctions in place if you're elected?
When I was president, Iran was broke. They were broke. Stone cold broke. And you did a story, I remember once, but everybody was. There was no money for terror. Hamas, Hezbollah had no terror because they had no money. They had no cash. And Iran was broke. They had less than $1 billion. They were at $600 million. They wanted to make a deal with me, and then the election was rigged, and we had a different little problem came up with the COVID and with all of the different things that took place in that horrible election. That election was the worst election in the history of our country. We're going to have the best election in the history of our country, and it's going to be a beauty, November 5th. You know, the one thing, you can't really say November 5th anymore. In the old days, you could have a date. But here you have all these early dates, September 22nd, September 29th. You have dates all over the place. We used to have election day. Now we have election period, unfortunately. It was so much better the other way, but what are you going to do?
President Biden seemed to me to be afraid of everything, afraid of China, afraid of Russia, afraid of Iran. I don't think you were afraid of anything. Do you think he's afraid of like Xi and Putin? Because this is the most tremulous administration I remember, and I remember Jimmy Carter.
So I think, well, he's far worse than Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter is like a brilliant president if you compare him to Biden. Jimmy Carter never let 18 million people into our country, many from jails and prisons and insane asylums, okay? He never had anything like this. Jimmy Carter's a happy man now because his presidency was considered brilliant by comparison to this guy. This guy is the worst. No, he's afraid because of a different reason. He's a thief, a total thief, and he's taken millions and millions of dollars from China and Russia. Remember when he got $3.5 million from the mayor of Moscow's wife? And I brought it up with Chris Wallace, and Chris Wallace said, you can't bring that up. That doesn't belong here. I said, it's a big story. And 2 months later, it turned out to be a big story. He didn't want me to question him. I said, how come you got $3.5 million from the mayor of Moscow's wife. Remember that? It was a big deal. And Chris Wallace, how's he doing, by the way? Chris Wallace wouldn't let me bring it up. And I said, well, I'm debating two people then, which is
you. You were. That's why I'm afraid about moderators. But, Mr. President, do you think Joe Biden is afraid of Xi Jinping? And do you think Xi is like a Mao or a Napoleon or a Caesar? Is he on the march everywhere?
Yeah, well, the answer is yes and yes. He's definitely afraid. But he's also afraid because Joe Biden is a Manchurian candidate in the truest sense of the word. He is being paid off by China, and he's being paid off by Russia, and he's being paid off and was paid off by Ukraine. You take a look at that. Just look at it. I mean, the money is coming from every different angle. So he's worried that if he is tough like I was with China. I took in $500 billion in tariffs. Not one president, and it was going up, not one president has ever taken in anything from China. Now he puts a tariff, finally, it should have taken place 3.5 years ago. He puts it on the electric vehicle, but that's going to destroy other vehicles. You got to put it on everything. He just put a tariff on China the first time he's ever done this. And the only reason he did it is because the election's coming up, and he wants to sell this ridiculous EV mandate, the all-electric car that people don't want. 5% want it, and certain people want it, and, you know, it doesn't go far. It costs too much, and they're all going to be made in China. But he's a Manchurian candidate, and I believe he's weak in China because they know how much money they paid him and his family.
Now, Mr. President, I'm going to take a break here and send some folks away and keep other folks, but I switch out stations, as you know. At this point, we leave some, and I want to give them that signal. I got to ask you about the Washington Post story last week that said the Biden administration is holding back intelligence on where Sinwar is on the tunnels. He's surrounded by hostages, probably American hostages. You brought back like 60 hostages with Ambassador O'Brien. What do you think of our holding back intel from the Israelis on where Sinwar and the hostages must be?
It's not even believable, and it's not believable that they're trying to get. Look, we don't want Austin and these guys telling our ally, and a very important ally, by the way, how to fight their war. They've got to get that war over with, and they've got to do it very fast. You know, people are now starting to say October 7th didn't exist. You know, here goes the misinformation machine. They're saying the war that never took place, October 7th never took place. It's the same way the same people that say the Holocaust never took place. And that's starting to hurt Israel very, because there are a lot of people that believe it. I was watching the other night, and these kids are saying, you know, these kids that are protesting, when they accepted an interview, a little interview, they said, oh, October 7th never happened. That never happened. I never heard about that. It's like incredible. Israel has to finish this off quickly. And I wouldn't listen to the people that gave us Afghanistan and the people that gave us all these failures, these military failures that we're involved in.
You know, Mr. President,
listen to the people that wiped out ISIS. You know who wiped out ISIS? Donald Trump.
Yeah, when you ran in 2016, you surprised me. You surprised everyone when you won. I think one of the keys was you put out a list of possible Supreme Court justices. Would you consider putting out a list of your national security team possibles? I mean, people like Rick Grenell and Robert O'Brien and Mike Pompeo and John Ratcliffe, they're all going to be there somewhere. You don't have to name where they're going. Tom Cotton,
yeah,
Michael Waltz.
That's an interesting question. The answer is yes. I think it's a great idea. Nobody suggested that but you. See, you're a step above. Nobody has suggested that but you. It's a very good idea. I will be putting out a Supreme Court list.
Oh, good.
That's a very interesting idea.
Yeah. Well, if you just listed a half dozen people, and I know Grenell and I know O'Brien, these are my friends. I know Waltz is on your list. And I've seen the vice president list. By the way, does Doug Burgum have this locked up?
No, but he's very good. I tell you, he's really good. He's an expert. You know, he made his money, made a lot of money in technology. And yet he's, to me, I think he's more of an expert on energy. He's a very talented guy. He has a great wife and family. He's running.
You know, they don't give out Stanford MBAs. It's like Penn. He knows what he's doing. He is very smart. I wouldn't let him just run energy, Mr. President, whatever he ends up doing. But we're going to need a massive overhaul at DOD. You know how wasteful it is. We need a Waltz. We need a Pompeo. We need a Cotton over there. I'd love to know who's on your list just so we could assure people that there will be reforms at DOD.
Well, all of the people you mentioned are real candidates. I mean, everybody you've mentioned. I mean, generally speaking, the people you like are the people that I like. I mean, to be honest with you, all right? You're not going to see some of the clowns you have right now. That I can tell you. The people that we have right now, the Afghanistan, what they did with Afghanistan, and to have nobody fired. You know, I was a firer. Not that I want to be. I don't want to fire. But I would get rid of people if they did something where, which was, how about not one person was fired? And Afghanistan was the most incompetently. Afghanistan gave us Russia going into Ukraine, that's for sure. And it gave us China getting frisky. It was so badly handled. I mean, grossly incompetent to move the soldiers out first. You know, that was 90%. They should have used Bagram. And by the way,
you know, Mr. Bagram. President, you just reminded me, former President Nixon, with whom I was close and you were a good friend, said his big mistake was he didn't fire people fast enough. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of his resignation. At the Saturday rally, your 100,000 people rally, you used the term the great silent majority of Americans, which Nixon first used in 69. Did you know that he had used that term before?
Yes. Very well. And I love the term, because I have a big silent majority, the biggest, I think the biggest ever. We had 107,000 people at that rally. The final count just came out from, I think, the town or the fire department. 107,000 people. I expected 40, 45,000. We had, by the way, if Biden went down to do a rally, he wouldn't get 50 people in that same location. He wouldn't get 50 people, and you know it. And by the way, nobody else would get more than 200 or 300. We had 107,000 people at that rally. That was, you had to see, it was a wave of people. And the town did a great job.
Well, when Nixon brought up the great silent majority on TV, he got hundreds of thousands of responses because it struck a chord. Are you looking for those same voters, people who love America but don't necessarily say much?
Yeah, so Nixon used the term silent majority. I added the word great to it. I have great silent majority. I didn't, you know, that the term was very, very powerfully associated with Nixon. And I didn't want to be copying the term, actually. So it's the great silent majority. And I did use it pretty much. I haven't used it much, pretty much for the first time in an important location in this.
Oh, it's a great phrase. I think
it got a tremendous response.
When you became friends with Nixon in New York, did you ever talk presidential politics, how he ended up resigning, how he won so big in 72? Did you ever discuss it with him?
His life to me was very sad. It was a very sad life. You know, I got to know him really more when he was out. He watched me his wife watched me on the Phil Donahue show, and she wrote a letter, which I have. She wrote a letter, which he gave to me. He wrote me a letter saying that my wife, Pat, who he really loved, by the way, really loved, but that he sort of had very few friends, you know, she was his friend. But he wrote a letter, my wife, Pat, said that someday if you wanted to be, you'll be president of the United States. It's become somewhat of a famous letter. It's from him explaining, she watched me on the Phil Donahue show. Remember that?
Oh, I know the story well, and it's absolutely true. But let me ask you about this.
It's very cute.
Nixon had people who hated him reflexively for 50 years. You've got people who, in this country, who hate you more than they hate Xi and Putin and Khomeini, these dictators, these torturers, these human rights crimes. What do you put that down to? Why do they hate? They're deranged. And I don't want you to get in trouble with the judge. Don't mention the judge. He's got an unconstitutional gag order on you. I think it's loathsome 100%. What he's done. But don't talk about
totally
it.
Because unconstitutional.
I don't want you to get fined because of me.
No, I don't I'm not getting in trouble. I know exactly how to talk. You know, we have a gag order that, like, the likes of which nobody's ever seen. We're doing very well in a case, but we have a judge who I say is corrupt and conflicted. He's a corrupt judge, and he's conflicted. And nobody can believe the gag order. That's never happened in this country before.
This is banana republic stuff. But to go back to that, why do people hate you more? The people who are cheering on this judge, and this judge, I think, and certainly Alvin Bragg, why do they hate you more than Xi and Putin and Khomeini?
Because I won an election against somebody that was supposed to win. It broke up their game, like, rather drastically, in all fairness. If you remember, before that election, they thought they had it made. They took the convention center. They built the most beautiful venue I've ever seen. They spent $28 million building that thing. It was beautiful. They built a is like a picture. It was a beautiful picture of the United States. I've never seen anything like it. And then they lost, you know, the glass ceiling. It had a glass ceiling. It's a convention center. I actually was involved with it. It has a glass ceiling. They were going to break the glass ceiling. It was an election that they had in the bag, they thought, and they lost. And it's been, you know, they've been very nasty. And, you know, when you say, though, people that dislike me, I also have more people that like me. We just...
Oh, yeah. Dixon won a landslide. You could win a landslide. But what about a media burying the Hur report?
I just got a 95% approval rating in the Republican Party. That's higher than 86 that Ronald Reagan had. You know, I'm very popular in the Republican Party. I mean, hey, we got more votes than any president in history, the last election at 75 million. That was more votes than any president has ever gotten, sitting president has ever gotten by like eight. And, you know, that's pretty good. And
you know, the New York Times Siena poll this weekend said you're 12 points up in Nevada. Are you getting overconfident?
No, I'm not overconfident because I'm not overconfident because they cheat. You know, they cheat. Look, I have people saying, well, you know, you have to expect they're going to cheat 6, 7, 8 points. I said, I'm not expecting that at all. We have that, you know, covered, but they find new ways of cheating every time. It's they're professional cheaters. And I say it like it is, and you know it, and you shouldn't say it, because why should you get yourself in trouble?
Well,
but, you know, it's just one of those things. But
anyway. I like to say they buried the Hur report. Special Counsel Hur should have charged Joe Biden if there was one rule, the same rule that Jack Smith has used against you. But there are two sets of rules here. Does that drive you to distraction that the media has buried what Hur said and explained it away?
Well, I think it's a ridiculous thing. I also think that it's almost worse than if he said convict. They said he's grossly incompetent, and this is who we have running for president. You don't think that's going to be brought up? He got out only based on the fact that he's incompetent. I mean, think of it. I said, you know, I don't think I want to get out that way. I think I'd rather have to win it in trial, because that is a disaster. Very sad, actually, in a way. It's a very
okay,
sad
I have to report. Close with a few. Your people are going to be mad at me, but I want to close with a couple of very important questions. When Iran attacked Israel, we helped them. But then Israel was held back in their response. Should Israel have hit Iran harder in their response to the attack on Israel from Iran?
Well, I think they probably had a little side thing. You know, when I hit Iran, I hit them very hard, and then they had a hit back, and they called me, "We're not going to hurt anybody. We're not going to hurt anybody." That was on the military base, you remember?
My son was on that base at that time, Mr. President.
Okay, good. Well, then tell him to thank me for his life, okay? He'll thank me for his life. But, you know, we knew that those missiles were not going to do any harm, but they had to send a signal. I have a feeling there was a little bit of a signal sent, because that was a strange situation where they knocked down everyone and then Israel went in and attacked in a certain way, you know, and everybody was happy. So I think it wasn't so bad. That could have been catastrophic. But the bigger problem is, what are you going to do with Iran trying to get, you know, they're going to have a nuclear weapon soon. And when they have a nuclear, if you allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon, you're going to have problems like never before, because they are very difficult people to negotiate with. I did very well with Kim Jong-un, but he wasn't a religious zealot. Iran should not be allowed to have a nuclear weapon. They would never have had even close to a nuclear weapon. They are very close to getting a nuclear weapon. You cannot let that happen.
Did you see Secretary Blinken playing the guitar in Kyiv last night? I just don't know how he expects Khamenei to respect him.
It's not the look you want. I said it this morning. I told people, I said, this is not what we want. This is not central casting. And look, he's done a very poor job. The world is blowing up. And I will say, Viktor Orban, and you know him and you respect him. He's, you know, they say he's a strong man or a tough guy and all that. And he is. He runs a, you know, tough. Nobody came into his country other than he takes Ukrainians. I mean, he does take in Ukrainians, but he has nobody coming in, and they're not blowing up his shopping centers, etc. He said the only way you're going to solve the world problem, he was asked this question, is Donald Trump has to become president of the United States. When he was president, we had no problems. He used the word afraid. I would never use that word, because I don't want to use that, you know. And he said, China was afraid of him. Russia was afraid of him. Kim Jong-un was afraid of him. Everybody was afraid of him. We had no problems. The whole world was peaceful. Now the world is blowing up because nobody respects Biden. Nobody.
Well, you know what I'd say, Mr. President, is the President Biden and his team are afraid of everything. Their Biden doctrine is never don't retreat, and that Donald Trump wasn't afraid of anything, and that is what makes America strong. I have three more questions. You've seen the campuses. Your alma mater and my alma mater have failed terribly, Penn and Harvard. Should we cut off all federal funding to every college that has an endowment of more than $1 billion or $5 billion? Because I don't know why we're giving these places money.
Maybe you should do it anyway. You want to know the truth, because what they're teaching and the way they're teaching is ridiculous. But I'd probably recommend doing something. I think we should do something with endowments anyway. It's ridiculous. And then we subsidize schools on top of the endowments. The whole thing is ridiculous. When you look and see some of these things with $25 billion, and then they're coming to us for aid. Okay, the whole thing is ridiculous. And I'm going to look at the whole situation. It's one of the great... It's actually a tax scam in a very sophisticated way, and I think that whole thing should be looked at anyway.
Now, the great silent majority is with you on one issue that you occasionally bring up, so I want to ask you about it. The great silent majority rejects the idea of biological boys competing against biological girls in high school and even in college, but especially in high school. And it's not just right. The athletes. It's their families, their friends, their coaches. The great silent majority is with you on this. Is it going to be a centerpiece of your campaign to keep boys in boys' sports and girls in girls' sports?
Well, it is, but I'm embarrassed to say it's a centerpiece because who can imagine this is possible? You have to look at the weightlifting records. Have you ever seen? You
yes.
know, where 1 ounce stood for 1 ounce. 1 ounce stood for 12 years, and then some guy comes along and breaks it by numbers that I can't even tell you because I think they're so ridiculous. But who could do this? When you look at the speed records, you look at the weightlifting and the weight records, you look at all this, and then you have the sports where it's very dangerous when you're competing. Now I understand they want to have football. They want to have girls playing on football teams. And they don't want it. And it actually is very demeaning to women. It's a very demeaning thing to women. It's hard to believe. I mean, sure, centerpiece, yes. But I hate to put it as a centerpiece because it's so ridiculous. It's like open borders. I say there's things that they do. There's no. I call them the no common sense things. Men should not be allowed to play in women's sports. And women don't want them. You know, I'm yet to find people that really want this other than far-left lunatics.
There are a lot of far-left lunatics in the country. Let's wrap up by talking about the far-left lunatics at the United Nations.
That is true.
The very first time I interviewed you, we talked about the UN remodel because of your testimony years ago, which was hilarious and
right.
on point. The UN has completely fallen on its face in the Israel war. UNRWA, right. Is it time to kick them out of New York, Mr. President?
Well, I wouldn't want to see that from a country standpoint. I wouldn't want to see that from the standpoint they could. You know, I've always loved the potential of the UN, but it's never lived up to its potential. And it's very much controlled by, I guess you'd say, radical left, but it's even worse than radical left in many ways. It's controlled by certain nations that shouldn't be controlling. You see what's happening. You see who's going on security boards and boards. It's like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard. But you know what? Just from the standpoint of, you know, I made my money in real estate. I made a lot of money. I'm good at real estate. Do you remember I offered to build it for one-fourth
yes.
the price?
Yes.
And it would have been, they said, well, what would be the difference? I said, it would be much better. You'd have marble floors instead of tile floors. You remember that? But I was willing to build it for 25% because they spent so much money. It was so ridiculous what they did.
You warned them that they were going to get taken to the cleaners by the unions, and they did. It was very funny testimony. Let's close here.
Yeah.
Are you going to negotiate? Are you going to negotiate personally the debates? Are you going to send Susie and Chris to do that? And if so, are you going to give them a list of people you'll accept as moderators and people you want?
You know, I'll be right on top of it. Look, I'd like to see more debates. I've accepted. I put out the letter. You'll see the letter. You'll read it afterwards. But I put out a letter. I think you'll get a kick out of it. I've accepted the two debates. I've recommended they should have more. I hate to use this group that does the debates because they cheated. They turned the sound off during one of my debates, and they go out of their way to help the Democrat, but that's okay. You know, it doesn't matter. Ultimately, you're still up there with one person, so they can do whatever they want to do. But I think there should be more than two debates, I think, and I've accepted the two. 100%. But I think there should be more than two. And I think they should be in large venues. It's just more exciting.
Well, but it's harder to hear. You know, I've been on the other side of you. It's harder to hear when the people are cheering and it's, you know, it's not a conversation like this.
Well, that's only because of the debate people. You know, you remember whenever I looked at Hillary Clinton, they turned down the sound so, you know, she wouldn't get spooked, I guess. I don't know. But they turned down the sound. And we caught them. It's on tape. They sent me a letter of apology. They cheated on the debate. And I don't care. Look, it's two people standing on. We'll have people back there that they can't do that. But they're very, very radical left debate. They're really Clinton people, to be honest. They're more than anything else, they're like Clinton people. But I don't care about that. I think it's important that we have debates. I think we should have more than two. But I've accepted the two. But I feel that the large venue is just, it's a very exciting night. And when you don't have that, it takes a lot of a lot of energy out of it.
Very last question. I am surprised by the Siena New York Times polls in Michigan, mostly in Nevada. You're ahead in Arizona. You're ahead in Georgia. Are you going to compete in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan? I mean, Pennsylvania, you're ahead. But what about those three states in the upper Midwest?
Well, I think I'm doing really well. We just had a poll come out, not that one, in Michigan, where I'm up 9 points. We just had one come out in Minnesota where I think I'm up one. You saw that one yesterday. I'm up 1 point. You know, the Minnesota is amazing because I go to Minnesota, I say, we're going to win this state by a lot. And I thought we won it last time, actually. I really thought we won it. But it hasn't been won since your friend Richard Nixon won in 1972. Who would think that, right? Minnesota.
Well, the last one I saw had you behind two, but within the margin of errors from KTSP yesterday. But, I mean, that's astonishing. It is Minnesota. It's a Democratic farm labor. It's a hard left state.
Yeah, I never viewed it that way, but it hasn't been won by a Republican since Richard Nixon in 1972. And that's amazing to me. That's really amazing. That's the one the longest because, you know, they had Reagan almost won everything. He almost won, but he didn't win. He did not win Minnesota. That's right.
Are you going to bring the Senate with you and the House back with you in Republican majorities, Donald Trump?
I think we have a very good chance. We have some very interesting plans on the House, and we have some. The Senate is, you know, if you listen to people like you, I think the Senate would be looking a little bit stronger than the House in terms of winning. I think we're going to take both. And I mean, were you surprised by how strong the New York Times poll was?
Oh, yes. And I think most of the left is stunned and they don't know what to say. And they're afraid. And therefore, you're getting more and more heat in the New York trial, which is an absurdity. And I don't want to get into it. It's a circus. It's a show trial. It's a terrible scar on American judicial
history. Well, it's election interference. It's their form of cheating this time. They always find a way to cheat, and they're cheating with those trials. And they're nothing, those trials. Those trials.
Well, they're not letting you campaign 4 days a week. It's just right there. You can't go out 4 days a week.
Thank goodness I can speak to you. Thank goodness I can speak to you by telephone, unlike Joe Biden. Would he ever take your call? I don't think.
No, he doesn't do any interviews.
Can you imagine
Joe Biden
doing an interview like this? Can you imagine him doing an interview with you like this?
He's more than welcome. He will never show up, Mister. I've met him once. I've interviewed him once outside of an AIPAC convention. He's turned his back on Israel. He'll never come here.
Show up to the debate. He may never show up to the debate. I know he accepted the debate. You know, accepted more or less. He sort of accepted it. But let's see if he shows up. It's all misinformation, disinformation. Oh, sure, I'd love to debate. I want to debate. And then you can't make a deal with the guy. Let's see if he shows up to a debate. But I've accepted. I'll go anywhere, anytime, any place, and we'll see where it is, you know?
Bonus question. Your chief of staff in a second White House. It's going to be Rick Grenell or Mike Pompeo?
Well, they're both good, and Rick has been really outstanding. I mean, he has been he's been something very, very special.
Because you once told me the two most important jobs other than president were chief of staff and national security advisor. So those two matter a lot.
And attorney general. I got attorney general wrong. That one I got wrong. But attorney general is very important, too. Yeah, they're all important. Honestly, every position is important. And we had a lot of great people. Lighthizer did a great job. We had so many great people. But sometimes you get them wrong. And you know, the difference is I went there. I was not a Washington guy, and people were recommended. And for the most part, we had great people. But we had some people would never be there again, that I can tell you. I know.
Well, you know, Senator Cotton would make a great AG, but you might want him at DOD. Once again, I want to close with, I hope you put out a list of your AG is part of the national security team.
By the way,
I hope
Cotton
you just put out a list.
Cotton is a very good man. You're right. More and more people are mentioning his name. More and more people are mentioning his name.
Mr. President, keep coming back. Good luck in this campaign and many more rallies. If you go to Ohio, by the way, you'll get double the crowd that you got in New Jersey.
Well, it was a great honor to see that crowd. I mean, it was like we expected 40, 45,000, and the people just didn't stop because they're looking for hope. It's so bad what's happened to our country. They're looking for hope. They want hope. And we're going to give them more than hope. We're going to give them fact. We're going to give it to them. We're going to bring back our country. And, you know, to use our greatest expression of all time, we're going to make America great again. That's what we're going to do. And thank you very much, you.
Thank you, Mr. President. Be well.
So long.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt here, joined now by Congressman Michael Waltz, a member of Congress from Florida and the Jacksonville area. Congressman, by the way, are you a Jaguars fan? I would hope that's not the case because the Browns are playing the Jaguars this year.
Oh, heck yeah, I'm a fan, Hugh. I've been a fan since the franchise just opened in 1995.
Okay. We're going to put a hurt on you this year. I'm sorry.
Serious quarterback, serious program. It's a new Jacksonville Jaguars.
All right. We're going to put a serious hurt on you this year, but we'll come back to that. Congressman, I just talked with the father of three IDF soldiers who are deployed in Gaza right now. They're involved in the urban fighting. The first IDF soldier to be killed in Rafah was killed hours ago as they press on. What do you think Israel should do in Rafah right now? I'm going to come back with a couple more questions on this.
Well, first, I mean, my heart goes out to that father and all of IDF families because what the IDF is doing is literally putting its soldiers at risk, putting them in harm's way by warning Hamas and the Palestinians where they're going, when they're coming, dropping leaflets and saying, please clear the area. This is exactly where we're going to come. And oftentimes, letting the Hamas fighters live to attack and kill and maim another day in order to avoid civilian casualties. All of this is in the name of avoiding civilian casualties, none of which Joe Biden will highlight and none of which he will openly talk about and give the IDF credit for. And instead, he's on the international stage shaming the military of our ally in the middle of a war when either they make a mistake, as they did in the World Food Kitchen, or when civilians are killed, but typically, almost always, it's because Hamas is using them as human shields and oftentimes won't let them flee the fighting.
Do you see any alternative?
Going forward, Hugh, it's going to be street to street, house to house, trying to take a scalpel into take out 20 to 30,000 fighters hidden amongst millions of people in extremely dense urban terrain where they're very effectively using tunnels to avoid drones, to avoid surveillance, and to move amongst these pockets. It is probably the toughest warfare that you could possibly imagine.
I forgot. I've got two new affiliates in Illinois, and I should let people know that Mike Waltz is a Green Beret, and he's on the House Intel Committee, the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and the House Armed Services Committee. So he knows of which he speaks. He took the baton from Representative Gallagher when he retired. And again, that's the big three for me. Do you see any alternative, Congressman, to the Rafah operation? I listened to Dan Senor interview Benjamin Netanyahu on the Call Me Back podcast. They can't leave four intact battalions of Hamas, which are now strengthened by the refugee Hamas fighters who've come from the north and reassembled in Rafah. Do you see any alternative to finishing the war there?
No, the only alternative that I would see is if they somehow decapitate the leadership and kind of take out Hamas that way, and that then causes some type of surrender or some type of negotiated solution. And the Washington Post reporting, which I plan to dig into this week on the Hill, the reporting over the weekend, that apparently we could help with providing the Israelis the location of some of their Hamas's most senior leaders, but were withholding it in order to get them to not go into Rafah. If that reporting is accurate, you are going to see fireworks exploding from my office and from many others on the Hill, because that would be one way to prevent larger fighting in Rafah. However, as other reporting has shown that I do believe is accurate, Yahya Sinwar, the military leader of Hamas, literally has himself surrounded by hostages as human shields at all times. So it's just an almost impossible situation the IDF has to deal with. And then on top of all of that, they get, you know, Joe Biden, for political reasons, pulling the rug out from under him at every turn, because people ask, why have they gone in so gradually? Well, one of the things IDF has been trying to do is apply more and more pressure for the negotiations to get the hostages out. And yet every time they try to apply pressure, Joe Biden on the international stage gives Hamas an off-ramp and makes Israel look like the bad guy.
So, Congressman, yesterday you sent a letter to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell, urging that they put a hold on all Biden appointees at DOD and I believe state until and unless he lifts the arms embargo. What's your hope of success there?
Well, again, I need to go in and get the full briefings. Now we're hearing that it has been lifted, that Biden is sending the package forward, but minus just the 2,000-pound bombs that they're afraid the Israelis would use in Rafah. And again, that's just a ridiculous notion. I have worked with the Israelis. They follow many of the same procedures. And before you launch a strike, they often conduct what's called collateral damage estimates. Basically, if we hit this building with this type of ordnance, what will be the collateral damage to the other buildings? How many civilians do we think are involved or in the immediate area? And they use the appropriate ordinance to take the bad guy out, but do so with as literal collateral damage as possible. Part of that package has kits in it that allow regular bombs to become precision guided and then small diameter, which could take out like a bedroom versus an entire building. So I want to see how they're trying to parse this. Now, Hugh, here's my suspicion. The administration saw the blowback, so they sent the package forward, and then they're going to let a Democrat senator, probably Van Hollen or whomever, who have been really railing on the Israelis, to then put a quiet hold on it somewhere down the line, which any senator could do.
Oh, my, I didn't know that. Now, this morning, Congressman, 50 missiles, rockets came from Lebanon into northern Israel, which has been evacuated. That's in response to the Israelis taking out a Hezbollah commander in a very surgical strike. 50 missiles, some of them guided, some of them not guided. Do you think Israel is going to have to invade southern Lebanon in order to end this phase of the fighting in the Middle East?
Yeah, well, the IDF leadership that I talk to say it's a matter of when, not if, that they have over 100,000 displaced Israelis that cannot go home, that cannot go back up north because of the low level, low intensity, but very serious fighting that's going on. And they themselves fear Hezbollah, October 7th, but with Hezbollah in the north. And that they, one way or another, either Hezbollah is going to have to withdraw out of that zone, that southern zone, which they should be withdrawn from anyway under an agreement with the UN. The UN force there just isn't doing their job, to no one's shock or surprise. But one way or another, they're going to create that buffer. They hope Hezbollah does it voluntarily. If not, the IDF is going to move in and do it, and that will be a whole other and even, I think, exponentially more violent and difficult northern front.
Now, Congressman Waltz, I want to bring up the I'm going to talk to the former president later, and I'm going to talk to him about the Department of Defense, because today China is there's a picture out of their new carrier, which is a drone only carrier. They're ahead of us. And the DOD under Trump and you have been mentioned as a possible Secretary of Defense. I think it's got to be shaken up top to bottom. Our contracting has to change. Our Navy has to expand. But you're an Army guy. Do you fundamentally agree with me that our Navy is the thing that needs to get the money right now?
Yes, Hugh, I do. We are a maritime nation. 90% of the world's trade moves over the oceans. By point of comparison, you know that we talked about last week, I launched a national maritime strategy of President Trump. When he comes in November and says we need a 500-ship Navy, we don't have the steel, the aluminum, the wrench turners, the shipyards, the workers. So part of it is going to be attracting that foreign investment. But what President Trump knows is that our real strength isn't necessarily our military. It's our economy. It's our industrial base. It's getting back to that arsenal of democracy. It's making shipbuilding and manufacturing great again. And that would be the focus. But I'll tell you, any future Secretary of Defense under him is going to have to clean house. The place has gotten so bloated in the Pentagon. It's sclerotic. I was just with a group of tech entrepreneurs and people introducing all kinds of new technology and ready to innovate. And the entire conversation was their frustration with getting their ideas and getting their hardware that our soldiers absolutely need in front of the right people in the Pentagon to get it acquired. And what the Pentagon keeps doing is tacking on these new kind of rapid capabilities offices. Well, I just found out there's 281 of them now. Rather than fixing the underlying problem, they just keep bolting these defense innovation university, strategic capabilities office, strategic capital office. Then let's fix the underlying issue rather than, you know, tacking on all of these new little innovation units.
You know, so, I talked to Joe Lonsdale last week.
There's a lot of work week. To be done, but
I talked to Joe Lonsdale last week about his submersible company, and he wants to become a prime. And apparently, it's impossible to become a new prime because the DOD is so sclerotic. Can that be changed quickly enough? Because we're no longer talking about the Davidson window; we're talking about the Biden window. And during the transition from Biden to Trump, if that happens, it's maximum danger, I think, from the CCP in Taiwan. How long will it take to shake up the Pentagon to get it to buy what we need more quickly?
Yeah, and you're right, Hugh. In many ways, we're out of time. The biggest thing a new secretary can do is come in there and say, in the contracting process, prioritize commercial off-the-shelf COTS. And that before any service, any agency can go to, hey, we're going to make this new bespoke kind of Ferrari of a weapon system, pull what's already out there, modify it a little bit if you need it, and use it and go. And that Joe Lonsdale, his company, Anduril, Palmer Luckey's company, and others are exactly the new type of innovators we need, having a primetime seat at the Pentagon, not having to subcontract to all of the big guys. We have to do it quickly. But Hugh, I want to be clear. My focus is getting President Trump elected. Nobody should be measuring the curtains.
I'm just saying, if he wins, we got a lot of work to do. Congressman Michael Waltz, thank you. I look forward to talking to you next week. From the Jacksonville area, sadly a Jaguars fan, but we'll fix that over time. They'll become a Browns fan. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back. From Studio North, joined by an old friend, Congressman Ken Calvert from California's 41st Congressional District. He's chairman of the House Subcommittee on Defense Appropriations, and it's always good to talk to you. Hello, Ken. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
I've got former President Trump coming up at the bottom of the hour. We're going to talk about Israel, I'm sure, but I want to begin by asking you, what do you make of President Biden's arms embargo? What can you do about it?
Well, it's outrageous. It's hard to believe. He picked this moment to cut off support. Israel's, obviously, you know, is entering the final stages of removing Hamas from Gaza, and we passed this bill, the supplemental just recently, and we also passed the appropriations bill that gave money to Israel, and that intent was to allow Israel to end this war and to use the weapons they need, the munitions they need.
Do you think the president's action violates the Impoundment Act? Because when Congress acts, and fund something and the president signs it, he doesn't have a lot of authority not to do what you've agreed to do.
The presidents of ministers in general have ignored Congress for too long. And I think you're right. I think we need to look into that and pound that. Right now, he needs to immediately release these munitions. They're sitting on trucks over at Dover, ready to go. Boeing's already cashed the check, and they're not going to give it back. So we need to get that assistance to him right now, and certainly we need to look into this Impoundment Act.
Who testifies in front of your subcommittee on this, Congressman? Because I think they really ought to be pressed on who is micromanaging the delivery of weaponry to Israel.
Well, my belief, that's Jake Sullivan is primarily involved in those decision-making processes, directing the Secretary of Defense. By the way, Jake is on the phone calling all the Democrats, whipping against this bill. They don't want any Dems to vote for this.
What does this bill specifically do?
What it does is it's a resolution sent to Congress. It blocks the Defense of State Department from canceling the delivery of defense articles or defense services to Israel. By the way, what we do know is that they've stopped delivery on 2,000-pound bombs, 500-pound bombs, some GDAMs, which are the kits that they're using to make these bombs, these so-called dumb bombs, accurate, which is what you need, and God knows what else they're doing in order to pressure Israel and not going into Rafah to finalize this war and to end Hamas.
Now, Congressman, I expect that will pass, and I hope they notice that, and I don't care if Jake Sullivan's lobbying against it. The CPI comes out at the bottom of the hour, and I expect it's going to be above 3% again. I was doing some research this morning. California, L.A., and Riverside have the worst inflation in California. So what are your constituents talking to you about in Riverside? Are they talking to you about inflation, or are they talking to you about Israel, or both?
Both, but obviously inflation affects people's lives. You know, gasoline prices in California are the highest in the country. And as you know, Riverside people commute to work every day and use several tanks of gas a week. And this is coming right out of their paycheck. And the price of groceries, the price of eggs, price of bread, price of just the commodities to live by is crazy. And if you've gone to a fast food in California lately, you know that you're paying 20% more, 30% more than you were just a year and a half ago.
We had sticker shock on Saturday night. We drove up north and didn't feel like cooking, so we went out to our favorite pizza place. I was actually kind of stunned that two pizzas can cost that much money. It's just astonishing.
Well, I was in the restaurant business, and I sympathize with people that own these restaurants and trying to operate, but they're only passing along the cost to the consumer that they're being inflicted by, and it's terrible. It's as you can see, a lot of restaurants are going out of business.
Now, Congressman, I want to switch up to politics a little bit. Speaker Johnson went up to New York to be at the Trump trial yesterday to speak because the president's under a gag order, which I believe is unconstitutional. Did you applaud the speaker for doing that? Because I do.
Yes, I think the speaker needs to, stand behind our president and our new going to be our president-elect soon and our nominee. And we need to unite behind him, all the Republicans, and put behind our differences and get behind President Trump immediately.
Well, I think Johnson is also a constitutional officer, and he needs to speak up for the Constitution. The First Amendment should not allow this. I know gag order law pretty well. I have to teach it. And this is just outrageous. So let me go to my conversation last hour with Michael Waltz. He agrees with me that the Department of Defense needs new primes like Joe Lonsdale and Palmer Luckey and people like that, and that contracting has to change top to bottom. Does that have to come out of armed services, or can APROPS do that, Congressman Calvert?
Well, we've been working together both with the authorizers and the appropriators on doing that. And by the way, Palmer Anderall has gotten a go-ahead to move forward on the new collaborative combat aircraft along with General Atomics. By the way, they picked two companies that are not primes. That's moving in the right direction. I think that what we're seeing with the so-called doomsday plane, where that where Sierra got the contract to move ahead on that, is that's good news. And so we need to keep the department moving in that direction to get innovators, people that are doing new things and putting out product for less money and a better quality in the end.
Well, Lonsdale explained submersibles to me, but I haven't heard anything about the Doomsday plane. What is that?
Well, there's two 747s that we have that, in case there's a nuclear war, that that's where the command and control will be located. They're getting quite old, and they need to be replaced. So here in Nevada, got the contract to build those two new aircraft.
This morning, I saw a story out of China that they are about to launch their first drone carrier. I didn't even know about it, neither did some of the other people who are defense followers. Did you know about it, and what do we have to do about our shipbuilding? Because they're just crushing us, Congressman.
Yeah, as you know, a substantial amount of trips in the world are made in China and South Korea and Japan. The United States pretty much left the shipbuilding business, and now we have to rebuild our capability, which is going to be costly and timely, and we got to get on it right away. I know a little bit about this so-called drone ship. The obviously drone technology has moved a long way, and we've got to move very quickly to make sure we continue to have our advantage. And our advantages are slipping, quite frankly.
Last question, Congressman. How quickly can we expand shipyard capacity in the United States? I know, for example, at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, they're out of capacity. In Maine, they're out of capacity. I don't know about the other shipyards. Where are we going to expand our shipyards?
Well, we need to utilize our private shipyards better. The public yards, as you know, are totally full, and we've got a backlog of ships for normal maintenance and obviously ship construction. We can't even meet our schedules on our Virginia-class submarine, which we should be at 2 a year. We're less than 1.5 per year. Even if they had the money, they can't meet that schedule because the workforce isn't there, and the capability and the capacity isn't there. So we need to rebuild our shipyard capability, and we need to do it very rapidly. That's going to take money. There's not enough money in the appropriation bill that I'm doing now, the FY25 bill. I'm talking to our friends, both the authorizing and Senate side. I know Lindsey came out yesterday about some mythology to get more money into the industrial base, the defense base. And so I think we have to have a serious conversation very quickly about how we do that.
Last question. Can we give some money to Australia and Singapore, the former to start building submarines and the latter to maybe have carriers dock at Singapore and not just Japan?
Yeah. Well, the technology exists for a nuclear submarine program. We are working with Australia under the LOTUS program. And Australia has committed money to do that. The problem is building nuclear ship facilities takes many, many years. And so what we need to do immediately is to expand what capability we have in the United States and then work with our allies to give them that capability over time. Japan is much further along in their shipbuilding capability than just about any one of our allies, and certainly South Korea. I think we ought to deal with South Korea and Japan, especially on our maintenance of ships overseas. It could save us a lot of time in shipping these back into the United States to fix them. It takes years and a lot more money, but we need to use our allies more effectively.
Amen to that. Congressman Ken Calvert, always good to hear from you, and good luck on getting the resolution passed today.
Get ready for a cinematic revolution. Experience the power of patriotism with The Relentless Patriot, hitting theaters nationwide with a special release on June 13th. Brought to you by Global Ascension Studios, Hollywood's first ever conservative movie studio. This gripping documentary follows the remarkable journey of Scott Lobato as he champions American values through his art. From stirring flag renditions to unwavering advocacy for our service members, Scott's story is one of passion and dedication. Don't miss your chance to be part of history as The Relentless Patriot makes its special release debut. Mark your calendars for a special release on June 13th and join us in celebrating American resilience and patriotism. Experience the impact of conservative storytelling with The Relentless Patriot, only in theaters. from Global Ascension Studios.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Olivia Beavers is with Politico. Olivia, I just had on Congressman Michael Waltz coming up, Congressman Ken Calvert. They are part of the House effort to blow back the Biden arms embargo. Have you heard this sentiment widely expressed on the Hill, and not just among Republicans, but among Democrats as well, that the president made a strategic blunder a week ago?
Yes, and I think there is a letter from about 26 House Democrats pressing the Biden administration about why they decided to withhold certain weapons and the bombs. But I think that Republicans found that this is a great point to get Democrats on the record in a party that's divided over Israel. And that's why they're having this vote that the Democratic leadership is actively kind of whipping their members to vote against, because they argue that it's an attempt to, I think the quote was, they are determined to hurt President Biden politically. And so Republicans, you know, now that they're past this internal drama that they've had for weeks on end, are now able to do some of these votes where they can take it to the campaign trail if they see Democrats voting against it.
Now, do you expect those 24 Democrats to support the new resolution urging the president to repeal his arms embargo?
You know, as I was talking to my colleague about this, I wouldn't say that we'd expect all 26 to vote for it, but those are certainly the names to look for. And there was one Democrat from Maine, I'm blanking on his name. Oh, Jared. Who signed onto a letter with other Republicans. So I would also very much expect him, if he's signing onto those kinds of letters, to maybe be part of this vote, bucking leadership, and he has no problem doing so.
Olivia, I know that you talk to all sorts of staffers in Congress, people of both parties. How are they reacting to this avalanche of terrible polling news? It looks like the bottom is falling out on Joe Biden.
Well, if they're Republicans, you know, they're quite excited. But it's a steady excitement, because when you're talking about the campaign trail, they feel like anything could change and give them whiplash. But they, you know, there's signs that, well, Donald Trump might be struggling to get his foot in the suburban realms, which last night might have indicated a little bit more. President Biden has still trailed pretty extensively from polls for months in the battleground states. And that might be why he's trying to change out his coalition. He had coalitions of young, you know, young voters in particular. And now it seems like he's trying to appeal to the Nikki Haley base and sort of change that up as he looks to kind of aid his campaign.
What did you make of Speaker Johnson appearing at the trial? My friend Robert Costa was tutting that this morning, but when you put a gag order on the presumptive nominee of a party, you can expect the party to rally around him. What did you think, and what do you hear about that?
My friends who are more in the legal community, I think, were aghast. The ones who are Republicans and say he has to decide what to do politically were more pro this decision. Mike Johnson just came off of a motion to vacate where Donald Trump protected him. And told Marjorie Taylor Greene to stand down on her efforts to oust him from the speakership. And Republicans openly told us that this put them in an awkward position where they might have been interested in trying to oust Mike Johnson. And because Trump got involved and said, don't do it, they didn't want to touch it. So I think Mike Johnson also is trying to maybe show his appreciation and, you know, continue working on that relationship. So honestly, to me, it wasn't a surprise, but the legal community, the Republicans that I talked to were.
You know, I'm surprised. I've been teaching con law for 27 years, Olivia. He's a constitutional officer. He's named in the Constitution, Speaker. And what the judge there has done has violated the First Amendment. And I am appalled by this gag order. Are other journalists appalled by this gag order? Because the president, then the presumptive nominee of the Republicans, cannot talk about the people who are sliming him. I mean, doesn't that offend you as a journalist?
I mean, I think that, you know, I haven't really talked to journalists about this, but I am not a legal reporter, so I know my boundaries. When I watch this and I let the experts sort of talk about it, and that's what I choose to listen to, but I wouldn't be... I don't think I've ever seen something like this, so I don't know how to, you know, what to think about it. But
there have been limited gag orders, the constitutionality of which has been upheld when there are circumstances that are very specific. They do not fit here. This is an unconstitutional gag order. And don't listen to the anti-Trump TDS legal community out there. Olivia, last question. David Trone got beat last night. He spent $61 million. How surprised are you?
I mean, so we talk about how important money is in campaigns. He crushed Alsobrooks in terms of spending, but yet he didn't win. And I think that was majorly significant. Now, she is going to be going up against Larry Hogan and will need money for that because he is widely popular in the state. But that there was a huge difference in spending. And I thought it was pretty wild that she was able to pull it off.
I don't know anything about Alsobrooks. Is she a moderate? Is she a lefty? I don't know anything about her.
I think politically she's quite similar to David Trone. There's not a lot of ideological daylight between the two, but she, she tried to appeal to the black voter base in Maryland, and she did a lot of work locally that will figure out for her.
Olivia Beavers of Politico, always a pleasure to talk to you, Olivia. Joined now by Mary Catherine Hamm on The Hugh Hewitt Show. She hosts Getting Hammered, the podcast, with her friend Vic Mattis. Good morning, Mary Catherine. I love your hair.
Good morning. You know, I didn't do it before I got here.
I love that. I've got to give you a story, Mary Catherine. We have a drive from the Beltway to the far north every year. It takes me 11 hours. It takes the fetching Mrs. Hewitt 8 hours. And so since we shared driving, it took 9.5 hours. Now, in the course of that, we listened to the Getting Hammered podcast. And we're horrified, mutually horrified, to hear that you and Vic are buffet restaurant people. That should be illegal, Mary Catherine. You can't go to buffet restaurants.
No, one of my great fears post-COVID was that the buffet restaurant would die a sad death and we would never have it again. But it turns out that we as a people, the buffet people, are resilient and we are back at it.
I have never been in a Golden Corral, and I'm never going into a Golden Corral, but I am just impressed that I just couldn't believe it. We had a vigorous denunciation of both you and Vic on the way. Now, I wanted to ask you about you and Steve driving. Do you squabble when you drive with Steve or he with you as about your driving?
Not a ton, I would say. I'm a little bit, I get a little bit of that nervous driver thing if somebody comes up too fast on cars, or nervous passenger thing, but not a lot. And he's a very solid driver, so it's not really a concern of mine. I think we grew up in the same place, so maybe we just have the same, like, middle of North Carolina driving style.
And no, we have the nervous passenger Hugh and the lead foot California girl. Now, I want to ask you about bridges specifically, because I'm one of those people that would prefer to look at my phone, read a book, or do anything except drive over the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. And you were saying that there are people like the Gettysburg Guides who stand at the edge of the bridge, but it costs $20 to drive people across the bridge. I would overcome my phobia for $20.
Well, here's the thing about phobias, because I have a bridge phobia. I don't like to drive over that bridge. Any bridge that sort of slopes in that way up and over makes me nervous. I think this is my dad has a little bit of it. His mom had some of it, too. And there have been times when I've been very nervous and had to, like, sort of fight it to get over that bridge. But the thing about a phobia is that if you feed that and you don't do the thing you need to do and get yourself uncomfortable, the fear will get worse. So if you're in a situation where you have to do that regularly, you should just learn to do it instead of paying
absolutely.
For it. But I get what people tell me.
I have a theory for you. I was a kid when the bridge over the Ohio River collapsed, killing many, many people. And I think there are going to be a whole bunch of kids who watch the Key Bridge collapse who have the same phobia going forward. We will see. Mary Catherine, it raised one other question about duties within a family. When one of your children throws up, who cleans up the vomit?
Well, a lot of times we're split up driving because the family's gotten so big at this point that we'll need two vehicles. but so it's whoever's in the car with the kid who threw up.
How about at home?
I think I'm usually the one. Yeah.
At home.
At home?
Yes.
It's like whoever's on duty. If you're driving the car, you're the one who takes care of the car. And by the way, car seat upchuck is the worst possible situation.
It is.
Sorry for hitting you with that.
Throw the car seat away. Throw the car seat away.
But my husband will reassemble the car seat, which is my favorite thing that he does, because I can clean it up. I don't want to put the thing back together and put it in the car. So he handles that.
In the parenting years at the Hewitt household, dads had the vomit duty. No matter what time it was, no matter what was going on, dad did the vomit duty. All right, let's get serious here. What do you make of the Trump trial? You're not a big Trump person. You've been a critic of Trump for years. This is a kangaroo court. This is a show trial, in my opinion. And the gag order is unconstitutional, in my opinion. And Andy McCarthy, also not a Trump person, has just destroyed the Merchant rulings. What does Mary Catherine Hamm think about it, if she thinks anything about it?
No, I would say, like many of the attempts to rid society of Trump that our friends on the left engage in, it actually makes me more likely to defend him, because he's right. You're not paranoid if they're out to get you, right? He's not lying about that. Now, he has other legal troubles that he's, you know, made his bed with, but this one is outlandish. The more I read about the details, because I'll forget some of the details, I'll circle around to another trial he's involved with, and then I'll come back to this one and get to the details. And the idea, this is something that's always bugged me, the idea that someone like Michael Cohen, who has been repeatedly untrustworthy at every turn and perjured himself, actually literally, is now trustworthy just because that person has turned on Trump, is an insane way to look at the world. And it was insane for every person they used in media incessantly. Michael Avenatti comes to mind. As long as you're anti-Trump, then you get the blessing and you go on TV and you say whatever you want. And this is just not how public trust should work. And the way that the charges are structured here, the way the judge is acting, the entire way this is coming together looks like using the tools of the justice system to get rid of and possibly jail a political opponent while you are running for president. This is a wild thing that they're doing.
The list is now Mary Catherine Hamm, John Podhoretz, Jonah Goldberg, and it is longer and longer of people who are Trump skeptical, who are nevertheless appalled by this proceeding. And I hope that you and Vic talk about it on the next edition of Getting Hammered. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Remember the movie The French Connection? Well, I have an Israeli connection. Her name is Stephanie, and she has led me to Yossi Klein-Halevi and to Aviv Rediger. And now my new guest, Dan Palazar, is the executive vice president of Shalem College, the first liberal arts college in Israel. And he's got three sons in the IDF. I believe they're all in Gaza right now, maybe only two out of three. Dan, good morning. Welcome. Where do we find you today?
You find me back in Jerusalem, having just returned from a trip abroad to raise funds to provide gear for soldiers, and having gotten in touch with each of my three boys. They've been in or near Gaza for the better part of this war since late October.
And one of them was wounded, thank God, not as severely as many others have been. And I want to come back to that. But first, and I want to make sure people understand, Dan Palazar is raising $6 million because the IDF is short on some gear and not providing it. What are you raising money for, Dan Palazar?
So we're raising money for the things that are most necessary to protect the soldiers. So if you think about protecting their bodies, they need tactical helmets that have a high ballistic rating. They need ballistic glasses. They need ceramic bulletproof plates and vests to put them in. And they need protective earplugs that are selective. And then if you think about longer distance protection, they need to know about threats before those threats turn into ambushes that kill or maim our soldiers. So it's things like drones, surveillance cameras, night vision equipment. Those are the main things that we're looking for, and there are a few other items.
Where do people go if they want to help you do this, Dan? Because when you're vouched for by Stephanie, I know you're legit and a very responsible curator of their funds.
So we're working with the Worldwide Friends Foundation and the Discretionary Fund for Israel as part of that. I can send you a link for how people can contribute to that. We're very low key. Our group doesn't have a name. We don't have a website that describes what we do, in part because these are the kinds of things you don't always want to put in writing, but people certainly can contribute, and I'm totally open to questions and comments and any thoughts that people have.
Please send that to me and I'll post it on my X feed. Now, Dan, I'd like you to, I haven't had the parent of an active duty soldier on yet, There were 60 rockets fired from Lebanon this morning at Galilee. Your three sons are in Gaza or have been recently. What has this 7.5 months been like for a dad of soldiers?
So what I'm going to describe about me is not unique to me. It's like probably any other parent who's there. My three boys are in different units. The oldest is in the reserves and he's in the infantry. My second oldest son is a platoon commander in the Nahal infantry. He's doing his regular army service as an officer. And my youngest is a combat medic. And I'm always thinking about how things are going for them, whether they're safe and such, whether they're doing well in what they're seeking to do, whether they're effective. I've never been this focused on my children before. And I have to say, and I think most Israeli parents are like this, I'm incredibly proud of my boys. I'm proud of their service. They're stepping up. None of them would call themselves heroes. To me, every one of them is a hero. They're just quietly doing the things that need to be done, because if you're a citizen of a state that's under attack and you have the ability to fight to defend your state, you do it. And for them, it's that simple.
You know, Dan, I have a son, a son-in-law, and a nephew on active duty. They've all been in harm's way, but not like yours. I mean, they've actually been under attack, but it's not the Gaza grueling 7 months every day. What's that toll take? Does it take a toll on a dad?
So I have to be totally honest. It should. And most people I speak to are incredibly worried when they're in my situation. The first few weeks I was worried because I didn't know what it would be like, and I didn't know how my boys would respond to being under fire and having grenades launched at them and shrapnel and those kinds of things. And I was very scared how they would react. Once each of them had been in combat situations and had responded calmly and, thank God, had come through it fine, I actually ceased to worry. I can't explain it. It doesn't make sense. But when I think about my boys, I think about their heroism. I think about making sure that I do what I do, what I can do so that they're as effective in their jobs as possible. But I don't lose sleep. I haven't lost my appetite. I know statistically, right, each of them serves with people who have been killed. Those people are in positions parallel to those of my sons. There, but for the grace of God, go I and my wife and my whole family. So it's not that I'm in denial as to what could happen and what still might happen down the road. It's just somehow I've been able to focus on doing what I can do to help them and doing what I can do to help other soldiers. And it might be irrational, but it's extremely functional. So I'm not trying to turn myself into a worrier.
So Dan Palazar, tell me a little bit about your reaction as the father of three soldiers in Gaza to President Biden's arm embargo last week and the pressure on Israel from the United States to essentially allow Hamas to win, to survive.
Okay, so I'll have to start by saying, as an Israeli, most Israelis, myself included, were between pleasantly surprised and thrilled by the initial support provided by the Biden administration. And that support was both words and it was deeds and supplies. And to be honest, it lasted longer than I expected and longer than other presidents have supported Israel in situations of conflict. I might be disagreeing with you. I know you have a view on Biden, but I wanted to be honest. I assumed you brought me on to be honest. So
yes.
For months, the United States was very supportive. When the administration seems to have taken the position that, well, this war can be ended, should be ended. Israel doesn't need to go into Rafah. Israel doesn't need to have American arms for this next stage. My view was a typical Israeli view. We appreciated the help when it was offered. Now, to a large extent, we're on our own, and we're going to fight on our own, and we're going to win on our own. Obviously, I would be much happier if our leading ally were providing full-throated support at this stage. As the leader of the Western world, that's what I would hope for, maybe even expect. But Israel was created as a Jewish state so that we could act independently. And even if we're totally on our own, we need to be able to fight our own battles. And now we're fighting our own battles. Would be better if it were otherwise, but I remain very confident in the ability of the army to win this war. I can tell you that my sons and all of the soldiers I've spoken to say, we're going to win this with whatever we have. They would prefer, of course, to have the precision weapons that the United States has spoken about stopping the shipments of, because those precision weapons make it possible to destroy Hamas infrastructure and to kill Hamas terrorists with the lowest possible toll on Palestinian civilian life. Israel doesn't have the option of not fighting. So if you take away the precision weapons from us, what you're basically saying is, we know you're going to go in, we know you're fighting to win, you're going to be causing more Palestinian casualties, which nobody in Israel wants. The soldiers certainly don't want. I don't want. So it's the opposite of the outcome that I would think the administration would like, but that's the reality we're in, and we'll do the best we can do in that reality.
Now, Dan Palazar, I don't know your politics. I don't want to know your politics. I don't involve myself with the domestic politics of other countries, but Israel is our ally, so I am shocked that we are withholding munitions. Do you think the Rafah operation has to proceed in order to destroy? I've heard Prime Minister Netanyahu with Dan Senor this week say, look, we've just got to do what we've got to do. We've got to destroy the four battalions of Hamas in Rafah, or they'll just emerge from the tunnels and take Gaza over again. Do you agree with that?
Completely. I don't see another defensible position, although I've heard that smart people have articulated other positions. It's very simple. Hamas did unspeakable, horrific things on October 7th, and its leaders have repeatedly promised to do them again. There is no plausible scenario for Israel that doesn't end with Hamas having been defeated and unable to continue its rule. And it's critical that everybody in the region, Palestinians especially, but Hezbollah and Iran, know that if you cross a certain line with Israel, we will fight to the end to destroy you, not because we want to destroy you, but because we want to live and we want to build. The meaning of leaving Rafah intact, with not just the four battalions that are kind of organic to Rafah, but to all of the other probably thousands of Hamas fighters who have fled there, is to, what that means is Hamas, the day after Israel pulls out, takes over the entirety of the Gaza Strip. They have victory pictures by the hundreds and by the thousands. And from the point of view of Hamas and the Palestinians, they have won. And from the point of view of the residents of the Gaza envelope, who cannot return to their homes out of fear of Hamas attacks, it means they remain vulnerable.
So Dan, can you stand by for a second? I've got to go down to a break. I want to tape you for 3 or 4 minutes more that I can play later. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm going to try and keep Dan Palazar, the executive vice president of Shalem College, the first liberal arts college in Israel. Three sons in Gaza. Stay tuned. I am back with Dan Palazar. Dan, 50 rockets from Lebanon this morning. What do you think? And all of Galilee is emptied of 70,000 residents. Do you think there's going to be a war in the north after the war in Gaza concludes?
So I listen to the very smart people who you interview on your show, like Haviv Retegor, Michael Oren, Yossi Klein-Alevi. Pretty much everybody has agreed that Israel is going to have to fight that war. The only alternative would be for Hezbollah to change its spots and to pull back behind the Litani and demilitarize to a large extent. But I don't see that happening. I don't see anybody pressuring them. We are a sovereign country.
My question, what do you think? What do your sons think? Do they think this war is going to go on for another year?
The war in Gaza?
Just the war generally. Israel's been attacked by 7 different fronts, if you count Iraq, Syria, the West Bank, Iran, the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah. I just don't know when this is going to settle down. What do the soldiers think?
The soldiers think that this war is going to be going on, and the soldiers, as far as I can tell, virtually to a man, want to keep fighting until Israelis can live in peace. That's their job. They're soldiers. They have to defend the country. They want everybody to be able to return to the north where they live and to the south. So I don't ask my sons, do you think you'll be in for 6 months or for a year? We just talk about they're going to be in and they're going to stay, and they and their comrades are going to fight until they have defeated Hamas and until they have destroyed Hezbollah's capacity to threaten our northern regions. If I asked them the amount of time, they'd probably tell me 6 months, a year and a half. But the main thing they'd say is, whatever it takes. That's why we're in the army. That's why we have a country. We're proud to serve.
Last question, Dan. Do you think this long war and 10-7 has fundamentally changed Israelis' collective view of their enemies and their future?
I think to a very large extent it has. Israelis have this tendency towards being naive, and roughly once a generation, that tendency is shaken up completely. It happened in the second so-called Intifada from 2000 to 2004, and a whole generation of Israelis understood we have to rely on ourselves and we can't trust promises of peace from people who aren't even willing to make those promises in a full-throated, clear way in their own language to their own people. October 7th was a massive wake-up call to Israelis. We are not going to forget this, especially younger Israelis who were very hopeful about prospects for peace, and they've seen them shattered and their friends killed and tortured and raped and kidnapped. Israelis are going to remember this for a long time, and we're going to be much more realistic about what our prospects are and what we have to do to survive in a very difficult region.
Dan Palazar, thank you for your time this morning. I look forward to that link that you send me so I can post it and let people help you, help the IDF. I appreciate it. Thank your sons for their service as well. And have a good day in Israel. I hope those rocket barrages stop soon.